Hi, I'm Andrew.
And I'm Spencer.
And we're here at the Slowdown's New York headquarters. You're listening to Time Sensitive, a podcast where we profile curious and courageous people in business, the arts, and beyond who have a distinct perspective on time.
Welcome to Time Sensitive. On this episode, Andrew's in conversation with the chef Dan Barber. He is the co-owner of Blue Hill in Manhattan and Blue Hill at Stone Barns in upstate New York. He is also the co-founder of the Row 7 Seed Company. What'd you guys talk about?
Well, a lot. But, you know, of course, Dan's known as a brilliant chef. He runs one of the most important restaurants in the world. But what I didn't know as much about was his perspective on food systems, which we got into a lot, and how he's thinking about making change upstream at the seed level. In talking about his journey to now, we get into work with genetics and seeds and the shifts he made through the pandemic that are really focused on food education. So he really turned his whole program around and overall just his approach to cooking and food, which he calls naked on the plate, which I love.
I've eaten at Blue Hill upstate. It is extraordinary. Can't wait to listen to this. Before we jump into it, though, I'd first like to thank our Season 5 sponsor, Le Col School of Jewelry Arts, which is supported by the Maison Van Cleef & Arpels. Since its founding in 2012, Le Col has created an incredible wealth of knowledge around the jewelry arts through its courses, conversations, exhibitions, and many other offerings.
Bringing the jewelry arts into the public realm, Le Col has had more than 100,000 visitors to 18 exhibitions over the past decade. These shows have included Invitation to the Voyage, Travel with Minerals, presented in Dubai in 2017, Birds in Paris in 2019, and The Art of Gold, 3,000 Years of Chinese Treasures in Hong Kong in 2021. Earlier this year, Le Col presented the exhibition Men's Rings at 2021 Design Site in Tokyo.
And opening this week in Paris and on view through October is the exhibition Engraved Gems, which presents approximately 200 pieces that tell the story of the art of engraved gems from antiquity to the 19th century. Exploring practically every facet of the long history of glyptic art, the exhibition brings together Greek and neoclassical intaglios, antique and medieval cameos, small sculptures from the imperial period, and rings. At the end of the year, it will travel to Hong Kong. You can learn more about Le Col and its exhibitions, past, present, and future, at www.lecolvancleefarpels.com. That's www.lecolvancleefarpels.com. And now, here's Andrew and Dan.
Welcome, Dan. Thanks so much for joining us today. You once said, tension is the area where the most excitement is created in cooking. And I've thought about this quote a lot and kind of reading about you and thinking about where you're at now and the amount of tension that must have happened in the last 3 years with everything. Did you find that you sort of were thriving in a crisis? How did you respond so quickly, stand up so many programs, pivot so quickly in early 2020?
Well, I'd like thank you for the compliment. I am lucky enough to be partnered with a non-for-profit that is very supportive. That makes it a lot easier to be free thinking and also has the ability to allow you to act on those thoughts. So I'm very blessed. But I do good thinking when I feel pressured. A chef named David Boulay, who was very instrumental to me, once told me in the heat of service, the heat of cooking service, that if my back wasn't against the wall, I wasn't really cooking. He loved to be on the edge. I don't love it. I don't feel emotionally attached to that in a way that I run to, but I do see the more and more as I get older, I see the brilliance of that. He said, if you're not kicking the soccer ball around, you're not really cooking.
So when things hit in January, February, 2020.
Yeah, well, that's a different kind of tension, because what he was specifically talking about is you're in the scrum, you know?
Right. Yeah.
So now you're in a different kind of scrum, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know, I haven't had experience with that, at least as acutely as we all did in March of 2020.
But you very quickly stood up this program, Resourced.
Yeah.
Which is built to support small independent farms. Why did you feel at that moment that's where you should be putting your efforts? And how did you sort of look at the problem and solve it?
Fear of failure. It drives, I mean, I don't know about you. I had a big failure. I always say that I think the determining factor for how I approach almost every situation, restaurant, cooking career-wise, stems from my having been a part of a restaurant that closed. The first restaurant that I was a chef at went out of business. The feeling of that is so a part of my DNA now. The fear of it is so a part of my DNA that just the stench of it, I scramble like a pit bull to attach to something so I don't feel that ever again in my life. That was an awful time. And I wasn't even my restaurant, and I wasn't even responsible for closing. The owner was like a coke addict. I had nothing to do with it. But still the feeling of that, of the people losing their jobs, of the doors closing, I just remember it just, you know, it stays with me. And when I started Blue, I really feel like that was the secret sauce to success, is that if you've felt that before and it had the kind of effect that on me, you would do anything not to have that happen again. So here I was in 2020, I was right back in the fear, up at night thinking of this is it.
But you were not just scared of your own failure. You were also scared of your distributors, your growers, everyone you were connected to.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, me, personal failures wrapped into that. What's the difference, you know, for me? Yeah.
Right.
My employees, yeah.
So how did you come to this, operationalizing this? How did you come to figuring this out? This was a very successful program, and very few people were that pointed and that quick at figuring out how to fix the problems.
The reason I was quick and pointed in the explanation of it and in the follow through is because I had to raise money to fund it. And what you start to realize, which I never knew, is when you go out to fundraise, you got a moment to articulate your vision with the kind of people who give money, and nobody listens. Nobody listens in general, but people who give money really don't listen. You got the tagline and that's it. So I got good at that quick. But again, I got good at it quick because I was like, this is my path out of not failing.
Right. And what were the results of that program? You know, did you see results immediately? Was it effective?
Yes, it was effective because, well, look, we had 238 employees or something, and we had to fire or terminate 180 of them. We ended up hiring a lot back, but at the moment it was very hard, obviously. The ones that we kept had been with me for a long time. So that would added more fuel to the fire. I wanted to make sure that we made it.
Right.
So the way to make it was to partner with a non-for-profit, raise money. A lot of people, you know, credit me with this huge successful program, and I love to take credit for everything. So I don't have a problem with that. But the truth is, like, there were two things at work. One was I had a non-for-profit to raise money for. And secondly, I had a team that was willing to pivot from cooking to packing boxes. They were earning 20% reduction in their pay, and some of them were earning minimum wage to do that. Most groups, restaurant groups, employees would just go on unemployment because, you know, the unemployment plus the benefits they were giving were much, much more. And so they took a big salary cut to do that. So I get a lot of the credit for being very inspirational and creative in thought. The truth is, you don't have the team there, forget it. That doesn't happen. And secondly, we had to raise the money because the thing didn't.
Yeah, but I imagine people don't go to you for a paycheck. They go to work with you because of the experience.
No, and I recognize that a lot of the reason I had that kind of allegiance was because of years and years of good stewardship. So I'm not being falsely modest, but you know, a lot of them have families now and mortgages, and you know, it was an interesting, difficult time. Anyway, I'm glad that I was lucky enough to be around an ecosystem of people that would support that, including the Stone Barn Center, which is a non-for-profit. Like I said, what I realized is that a non-for-profit and a restaurant could be quite interesting partners, which I had always thought of in a transactional situation, which is what we had been. Stone Barn Center is a non-for-profit. Blue Hill at Stone Barns is a tenant of that landlord. And we have a very close relationship in that we buy everything that the farm produces. We're good partners, but again, that was transactional. Now we were joined at the hip and we were raising money. If it was one program, it's very interesting. And I think what's come out of it is kind of a model maybe for the future of restaurants. I mean, restaurants are in trouble. That's what's not being written about. Is what's being written about, it's like the food waste movement. They talk about the bruised vegetables and pears. That's like the stuff you can see.
Yeah.
You know, restaurants close or nobody can get work, so they're not open for lunches anymore. The bigger, I think, systemic change is that creative restaurants that are bringing about a new food culture and an excitement around food, in one aspect, we will never go back. I think that it's gone for a long time. The economics of it don't work. And in a world where very few people want to work in the restaurant business anymore, for the moment anyway,
Yeah. And
in the world where rents are just impossible to do anything creative, I do not feel good about the next few years. I think the powerful brands and the powerful multi-restaurant chains will do quite well because there's going to be a real
room
opportunity. Yeah, room.
The quote that you had said from back then that I saw is this shattering of restaurant culture, this culture that defined a moment, and that's going to be forever changed. And on one hand, we're beginning to see QR codes go away and paper menus coming back, little signals of coming back. But what do you think beyond just the artisanal or creative projects that are happening in the food world, what else is changing in the restaurants that sat through it? You know, restaurant culture, people going to restaurants.
I think people will continue to go to restaurants because, especially post-COVID, if there is a post-COVID, that culture is not going to shift, is it? That train left the station. The question is, will people recognize the lack of service, the quality of the food, decline in quality of food, decline in the overall experience? I think we're going to be dumbed down to that because we're going to be so excited. People are going to be so excited to be eating out, and there's going to be not a lot of choice. It's just the overall definition of what it means to go out and have that experience is changed and will continue to, I think, be degraded. And you could say, well, there are a lot of problems in the world. Let's not rank that as the top one. It's tough to argue. I'm only suggesting that I think restaurants serve a purpose and a cultural importance that happened so quickly over these last 10 or 20 years in ways that I don't think were well understood. And maybe on a reflection, we'll look back on that and understand it better now. I think there's a loss of a potential for restaurants to play a role in a shift of food culture, which is, look, if we're coming out of COVID with understanding of anything, is that we're a very sick population and very inequitable, but very sick. And the inequity is not only in, as we talked about before, COVID and healthcare access. It's just in literal food access. What we're seeing is death from COVID. 92% of deaths have underlying conditions.
Yeah.
And the underlying conditions are obesity, diabetes, and hypertension. Three factors, and all three of those are food.
Yeah.
All three are food. Diabetes, adult onset diabetes, obesity, hypertension, that's all food. One way to say what I just said is like, there is a vaccine that's not being poked in your arm. It's food. We are going to come out of this, I think, with a general consciousness about that we never had before. I was just on the phone with a Rockefeller University scientist. He said to me, you take just one of those three that I mentioned, diabetes, hypertension, obesity, there's often comorbidities, obviously, so it's hard to, but if you could just isolate for diabetes, that's the big one. That is the biggest of the three, it seems like. He said, you know, we took a study of deaths from COVID now and we related it to numbers in 1975. He said, if COVID had hit in 1975, just with the fact that there were so few type 2 diabetes in the United States, COVID would have been a bad flu season. That's 1975. It's not 1865, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, it's not long ago. And look at what our eating culture and the way we think about food and produce food, what that's done to us.
And how cheap food is has so much to do with that.
Yeah, for sure. But cheap at the checkout aisle, very expensive.
If you take healthcare, on the healthcare
account,
side.
Yeah, the healthcare side. If you take that into account, it's extraordinary.
So you recently stepped down from the kitchen at Blue
That's
Hill.
Another statistic just
Please,
came
yeah.
across, but sorry to interrupt you, but it just reminded me that in 1982, we were paying 14% or almost 15%, 14.8% of our disposable income on food and about 8% on healthcare. And today we spend about 16% on healthcare and about 8% on food. It's totally reversed, but the question is like, are you ending up paying more? And you know, the answer in COVID anyway, for sure, is man, it's costing you a lot of money.
Right.
that's a very unfortunate, as I said, inequitable, but a very unfortunate American problem. And I say American problem because if you look at it, our statistics next to other countries that don't have this kind of propensity to produce food in the way that we do, the numbers are much different.
But to unwind that, you're going through a whole political system of lobbyists, of where money's going and where it's going to keep us unhealthy, basically, and where it's not going to keep us healthy.
That's right. I mean, that's why in some senses, when we started Blue Hill, we were called a farm-to-table, defining farm-to-table. And 20 years ago, I believe that was very important to demonstrate, even though it was not a new idea, it was an idea that could be demonstrated in a way that was deeper. And that's what Blue Hill's named after, my family farm, and the connection to that for my brother and I who started the restaurant together. And we did dig deep into that idea. But I think maybe it's COVID and maybe it's just my state of mind, but I would suggest that that kind of thinking, for which I've wrote a book and I spent my life devoted to this farm table idea, is not enough now. People always say, well, what can you do? What can you do to fight this? And I always talked about, you know, Michael Pollan has this great quote, is we vote with our forks and we vote three times a day. And that's a very strong way to advocate for the kind of food system. You know, I don't believe that anymore. I just don't believe it. We are now in a world where the corporate interests and consolidation is such that that's just not true anymore. You don't stand a chance. And especially inequities and access. But even without that, this system needs an absolute reset. And if COVID isn't the moment where we start to understand that and see that, I don't know what it is.
Because it was so visible.
So visible. It's so visible on our health, and it's so now visible on our environment, which it was for a long time, but it seems like that's now entered our consciousness. And with this, so there's a real inflection point. Where do you go? I mean, everyone's recognizing that we cannot produce food this way. We can't eat this way. So now there's a whole slew of opportunities for people to invest in alternate food systems. It's a very interesting time to be in this world, actually, because I think a lot that's being, the food's going to change more in the next 10 years than the last 1,000 years, I think. And what direction that goes is going to be very important for your three children.
Yeah. So you reopened Blue Hill at Stone Barns about 2 years after lockdown. But you changed it. There's a new program. You kind of reset. You stepped down from the kitchen.
I stepped down for those 2 years. During that interim, we did this box program. We brought in other voices, other chefs to take over the restaurant. And I just learned. I did a lot of learning.
Yeah, I'm curious about how you spent that time and what that sabbatical gave you.
My memory of it is very nice that I had that time, but also filled with regret that I didn't take more advantage of it. I spent a lot of time fundraising. It was a lot of time. I was a very inefficient fundraiser, I think.
You're new to it.
Yeah, that's my excuse. I actually ended up being okay at it, but I was inefficient. Reminds me of that, I don't know if you ever saw the Cheers episode where Norm the Big Drinker was hired for a firm that fires employees. And his first day on the job, he has to fire this sort of middle-aged man, and he sits down with him and he goes to fire him and he starts breaking down, crying. And the guy who he's firing is comforting him and he's saying, I'm so sorry, I have to fire you. He says, oh, please don't worry about it. And the next day he comes in to hand in his resignation. Say, of course, I cannot do this job. And his boss says, are you kidding me? You're unbelievable. The guy called me this morning to check in to see how you were doing. He wanted to make sure you were okay. And that's kind of like the way I was with the raising money. I was like, please don't give us money. I felt so guilty, like asking. I just, what ended up happening, and this was not a conscious plan. This just was sort of an accident, is that people felt they weren't being taken advantage of, because they weren't. I mean, I was laying out a vision for what a restaurant could be for the future. Anyway, I didn't do the bold ass. I did the very, why don't you sit back and watch us? I promise you in 6 months, I'll bring you back. And people are like, no, I want to support it now. Yeah, it's great.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's very good, big learning experience on how one would do that. Not that I ever want to go into professional fundraising, but it was interesting.
And coming out of that, what changed? What is the new version?
The new version is, I like to say, 60% restaurant. We're not 100%, we're 60% restaurant. So what are we doing with the 40% of the time? Well, first of all, we're not going back to the days when our cooks came in at 10 o'clock in the morning and we prepped all day. We had meetings and prepped all day for service, and then did service at 5 o'clock, did the first seating, which would end at 9, and then do the second seating, which is about 10 to about 1 in the morning. Cooks would clean up and be out of the restaurant by 2, be back by 9:30. We did that Wednesday through Sunday. On Sunday, we worked a double where you'd leave Saturday night at 2 in the morning and you'd be back at 8 in the morning. And then you'd work all the way till 1 in the morning. It was a very, very difficult service and a week. And I'll never go back to that again. I have no interest in that. I don't know that people would want to do that anymore. So we've changed it completely. So now it's 4 days a week instead of 5. and we do one seating. So we sit at 5 o'clock and we stop seating at 7, and that's it. So cooks are for the most part out by 11:30 or 12. They're home by 12, which is how I wanted it. The extra time in the day that we have, because we're only doing 40 diners a night instead of 100 diners a night, we've become an education center around gastronomy, around culinary, and we've become an R&D laboratory for ideas related to good farming. You know, we have a increasing language for what good agriculture should look like. We know that cover crops are important. We know that regenerative crops are important. We know that diversity is critical, critically important. Different families of vegetables on an organic farm has always been critical. But for an ecosystem functioning, you have to have diversity. Otherwise, you get run into all sorts of problems. The only way to do it is to prop it up with chemicals, which we've been doing for the last 30 years. I think that's become a mainstream idea. What hasn't become a mainstream idea is that in order for farmers to farm regeneratively, everything I just said is regenerative,
yeah,
you have to eat it. You have to figure out a way to inculcate that into the everyday habits of people who eat, you know. Otherwise, what are you talking about? Seriously, like regenerative farming by making degenerative food products? Well, that's not going to work for very long. And if we don't figure out a way to eat with the kind of diversity that truly supports the landscape, then there really is no hope. Unfortunately, there's a lot of people, smart people, who don't buy into that idea and are going in a different direction, which is technological, which is hydroponic farming or impossible burger kind of ideas that seem like catnip for people who have a lot of money and you can see a future in investment and feel good about it. But I don't buy into it. So I wanted to devote a portion of our intellectual capital in not just producing more dinners, largely for rich white people, and instead produce the kind of ingredients that our local ecology demands us to grow, and then figure out how do we create ideas around food and popularize them. And that is a collaboration with the Stone Barns again. So that's why I said the seed of what we're doing now really started in that desperation moment, which is why I think when your back's against the wall, you come up with ideas that I would not have thought of. So now here I am again raising money. I said I'd never do it again, but I really am. To cover the 40%, of our 60% restaurant, I got to raise money. And the center is paying us to do this research and development and run these education programs to the public and to partners and to disenfranchised communities who are partaking in all this research and education. Yeah. But I got to raise money. So I'm out there fundraising.
Right.
Which is
storytelling.
Storytelling. That's all there is. I just got through telling you about facts, you know, but facts, what, we're in a post-truth world, aren't we? Facts don't matter. There's only stories. That's it. So that's what I do. That's my donor pitch. It's just a story, telling a story. You know, luckily we're in a moment where there's a very good story to tell because like I said, I really do believe there's an inflection point. Where are we going here? And what have we learned coming out of this horrific moment? I think food is at the center of all this.
Well, I mean, we were talking about how COVID just made the cracks in these systems so visible. Issues around commercialized food supply chains, we understood that very early in the pandemic. And then food insecurity, which came a little bit later, but became very, very important. So for real change to occur, you know, back to what we kind of started with, at the local level, doesn't it have to really just start federally? How are these big shifts going to happen? How are we going to solve these? You model it, right? And you show this is possible. This is how we should be thinking it. But where is the real shift going to come from?
Do you think politicians are going to take the lead on this, really?
No, I don't. I'm saying the storytellers have to model it.
Right.
What's going to need to happen in politics?
It's going to have to get a groundswell of support.
Public support.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's the culture. It needs to be demanded. I'll never forget when I had the chance to cook for Barack Obama and Michelle. It was the night before their inauguration. It was the last night they were in their Chicago home. And it was just me and them and this guy named Sam Cass, who ended up being the White House chef and also instrumental in some of the food policies that the Obamas adopted and put forth. But so he had me come and cook for them this last night they're in the Chicago home. It was an amazing night. And a lot of talking about agriculture and farming and ideas around what the future could look like. This was 2008, remember? So it's like, you know, it's just like Middle Ages. These ideas that we're talking about now were not mainstream. They're pretty on the fringe. And we had a good spirited conversation. And then I got pretty exercised. I thought it was one moment to make my case, you know? So how many times are you going to cook for Barack Obama before his inauguration? Now, anyway, I left and I get in the car and I realized I left my keys. I don't know what happened. I went to the bathroom at some point, and I remember hearing something drop out of my pocket, for some reason in the car, I just remember, oh my God, I dropped my keys by the toilet in Obama's house, you know? So I went to the Secret Service. I was like, I'm sorry, I dropped my keys. I walk into the house again to go grab my keys. There's Obama in his pajamas drinking a glass of orange juice. You know, it's probably like 1 a.m. or whatever. I get my keys and he comes over to me and he puts his hand on my shoulder and he said, what you're talking about with change in agricultural policy, you know, those guys, when he said those guys, he was talking about these senators in red states who really control back then and still today pretty much control the whole food system. Yeah. And he's like, those guys scare me. I'm not getting near them. And I remember thinking right at that moment, your popularity right now is like 99.99%. You're more popular than Jesus Christ. And yet you're saying that you can't touch those guys. That was a big revelation. And the second thing he said to me as I was leaving was, but you can create the kind of groundswell that will make me do the things that you're talking about. Don't wait for me to do it. Make me do it. That was a big moment for me. What he was saying, which is obvious, is that politics move when there's a groundswell of democratic expression. And that's a big lesson for an idealist who believes that politicians, even ones like Barack Obama, will move mountains. And what he was saying is, at his height of powers, I know that I can't do it. And so much so that they even scare me. I don't want to go near it. So you do your work. You know, don't be lazy. Do your work. And then I will follow. But you have to give me the reason to follow. Okay. He's right. And that's, you know, that's what needs to happen. And one could argue that during the 8 years that Obama was president, we, meaning anybody who was involved in activism, didn't do a good enough job. And we didn't.
But you were invited. You were there. You were part of the...
I had a sort of whatever seat at the table, but I wouldn't even say that was sort of meaningless in the sense of personally, it was very enjoyable or flattering. But if you now look back on it, you realize what he said that night. It was like, go into your kitchen and do the kind of activism that needs to be done. He wasn't just talking to me. He was talking about everybody who works on this.
Sure.
Right? Not just white tablecloth restaurants. Obviously, yeah. Everybody bottom up and top down. My point is, like, I think, you know, now here we are 12 years later, and the very issues we were talking about then have just come to fruition. The kind of predictions that one was making about health and processed food and the strength of multinational food companies, the influence peddling and all that stuff. It is so ranked up now compared to, it was like a baby steps back then.
Totally.
Yeah.
And you track that all the way through Seeds. When the beginning of lockdown happened, many of us who were fortunate had their first gardens. It's like sort of not something a lot of people did, but all of a sudden you came with sourdough, right? People started gardening.
Right.
And Row 7 is a seed company you have that you started with Michael Mazurek. Some would say now it's like seed to table movement, not farm to table in a way. How did Row 7 come together? Why did you get interested in seeds? And like, what did you find when you opened up that Pandora's box?
Yeah. Well, that Pandora's box is a box that it's a rich Pandora's box. It's one that I'm never getting out of. I got into it because this is something that takes a second to unpack, but I maybe just to simply say that my food's very simple. That's all. It's just very simple. I'm looking at a guitar, so I'll just say it's unplugged. If there's more than three ingredients on my plates, I get itchy. I don't like that stuff. I never appealed to me. And I'm not good at marrying multiple layers of ingredients. What I am good at is getting to a moment, and it's a fleeting moment, where a broccoli is at its perfect thing. And if it's grown right, it can really be jaw-dropping in its impact. But you have to control a lot of variables, and you have to make sure that you're not marrying too much or layering too much. Because that is my cooking philosophy, I really started with, you know, getting the freshest broccoli, let's say, but then it led to which farmer's growing the broccoli that I actually liked last night? And then what kind of soil was that broccoli from? Because man, you could really, really tell the difference. And by the way, if that soil, you could tell, was it organic or not? It was always organic, always, always, always. It's like peeling an onion. Well, the next layer, and the layer which opens the box, is like, what's the seed? Because the seed was also the determining factor. The farmer was important. When the farmer picked it was important. How I cooked it was very important. But if you had the wrong seed, you were cooked. You were cooked from the beginning. To capture what I'm talking about, and that's what I was after. And as I said, chefs are pit bulls. For flavor especially, we'll do anything. And since I couldn't hide, I'm just saying that's just the way I express my art. I'm not saying it's as a proud thing. I am in awe of chefs that can do complicated calculus on dishes. I'm in awe of it, especially when it works. it's a genius I don't have. So I went and I recognized that. And if I did anything smart, it's that I went very dogged in making sure that when I present my simple plates that they really sing. And so part of that was to go into seed. So I started just getting to know breeders. And then I invited this guy, Michael Mazurek, who you mentioned, who became my partner in the seed company, for dinner. At the end of the meal, I invited him back to the kitchen. We were standing there and one of my cooks was preparing a butternut squash and just like a regular workaday, you know, butternut squash. It's like 85% of squash market. I was like, if you're such a great breeder, which I'd heard he was very talented, why don't you breed a butternut squash that actually tastes good? Why are we told to add brown sugar and maple syrup and butter and all this stuff to like make the squash taste like squash? I said, well, why don't you just breed the thing if you're so good? And what he got all serious on me, he was like, you remember, he like adjusted his glasses. He looks in my face. He's like, I've never bred a butternut squash that tastes good because I've never been asked to breed for flavor. I think that was 2010. And this time it was in February of 2010. And I think there's like a before and after moment for that for me. You know, I can imagine like the curtain coming down because that was sort of like, well, who the hell are you talking to, dude? And then of course you learn, well, breeders are talking to the industry and the industry, flavor is not a determining factor, that's for sure. Long distance travel is, yield is. And those things, when you select for them at the expense of flavor, you get very dialed in, very consistent vegetables and grains, but you don't get the kind of thing that chefs look for and chefs who plate simply really need. So I started working with breeders and Michael. And then 3 years later with Michael, anyway, he brought this squash that was a shrunken butternut squash, which turned into the honey nut, which today is grown coast to coast. We trialed it in the kitchen and I was talking about it with everyone I knew, and a lot of chefs around the country started to be very excited about it. It's a squash that's one third the size of a butternut squash, but it has like 10,000 times the flavor. It's so jaw-droppingly delicious on its own. You just bake the thing. It's a marvel. A marvel sounds like there's some kind of mystery or magic to it. And in fact, the truth is, it's just about what are you telling the breeder to breed for? And if you're telling the breeder, I want this jaw-dropping flavor, then the breeder will do that. And the yield's a little bit less. Actually, it's not that much less. This isn't an elitist squash. This is a squash that's now sold at Costco. So you're not talking about a squash that's just for Dan Barber and the White Tablecloth Restaurant. You're talking about a squash that's for everyday eaters. And by the way, not only will it change your opinion of squash, and it will, it has a nutrient density that is unparalleled. With 300% increases across the board, beta carotene. One spoonful of our squash is 300% more beta carotene than a butternut squash. And you start to realize
A third of the size.
Third of the size. So it's more money when you pick it up of the weight per pound, but it's a lot more squash because it's not filled with water. I mean, that in some ways, that's sort of the secret of the breeding work, is that you're not breeding for water, because that's what vegetables are bred for. They're bred to take on water because water's weight, and weight is where they make the money. And you're shipping across country, that's a very profitable business, and which is how our food gets cheap. But you're not farming for nutrients or quality, you're farming for water. And that's what a butternut squash is. I want to remind you, and I'm sure you already know, butternut squash is a superfood. So imagine what this honey nut, which is now in Costco and grown across the country and everyday people have access to. What do you call that? A super duper duper food, you know, I don't know. So that's why I started the seed company. It was like, I started to see there were dozens more breeders out there who had these kind of deliciousness in their desk drawer, literally. But the industry has said to them, nah, we don't want that. So what's the responsibility of chefs? It's to champion the ignored.
Right.
And the belittled, which is what the industry does. It belittles. I mean, flavor's under siege. I mean, that's just not a thing that, you know, that anybody is interested in. Except you've got a group of Gen Zers and millennials who, that's what they want. They want food with a story. They want food with flavor. They want to know where the food comes from. And oh, shit. That's a very big groundswell. So that's interesting. And that's why I say we're at this crossroads, because food companies recognize this. And that's why there's just a wholesale shift in like what it means to be an agribusiness company and what it means to be a seed company. Look, today, 64% of our food supply is in the hands of four companies. 64%. I mean, 64% of all seeds, which is our food supply, around the world. I'm not just talking about America, around the world, four companies. That's more consolidation than anything close in the history of the world. in terms of seeds. There's never been anything like, look, the first seed company was 100 years ago. So let's just remember that. There were no seed companies in the 1900s, in the early 1900s.
Communities.
Yeah, communities. You traded seeds. Seeds were free. Farmers collected seeds. You save your seed and you give it to your neighbor. And the ones that are really good, you pass on for generations. And today they're called heirlooms. But that seed company is just a whole new Megillah. Right. Now there's four that control almost, it will be 70% of our food supply by the end of this decade for sure, unless we do something dramatic.
There's four companies and then there's Row 7.
There's a handful of Row 7s out there that are the David versus the Goliath.
Right.
But the four companies aren't seed companies. They're chemical companies. Bayer is, you know, and ADM, these are not seed companies. These are chemical companies that own seed companies because they sell you the chemical. So let's just say what it is. It doesn't make you hungry thinking that our world's food supply is in the hand of four chemical companies, does it? No, no. And they don't. Who of the seeds is the way in? It's the Trojan horse. Because once you buy their seeds, you're hooked on a chemical cocktail to support those seeds. That's the problem. That's why you say, well, you kept unpacking and gotten to seeds, you know, and from seed to table. But if you don't start with the seed, then you're starting with a seed that's dependent on a chemical environment, which is going to degrade the soil, degrade the health of the vegetable, degrade the flavor. And what hope do you have? So if you're naked on the plate, as I am, you got to start with seed because otherwise, as I said, you're cooked before it leaves the ground.
So you were born in New York City.
Yeah.
And you grew up in the Upper East Side.
Yeah.
And you spent all this time at your family's farm in Great Barrington.
Yeah.
Is this where you first touched this idea of farming and agriculture? When you think back, how did the farm kind of shape the way you see it? Did you think of yourself as interested in these things at the time, or is it just kind of what you were doing?
I think I was, you know, it was a slow inculcation.
Mm-hmm.
No one was batting me over the head saying, you know, I got it. So my grandmother's farm, she didn't even know anything about farming. It wasn't farming. We had some people farm the land with, which I worked with, this great family that taught me everything. She was just interested in open space. She was interested in beauty and aesthetics and cows are a great way to preserve open space. So we tended to cows.
And you had this farm that you went to, but also this Upper East Side upbringing. Were you going to fine dining? Were you from a family that cared about food?
Yeah, my mother died when I was very young and my dad was in the toy business and he would entertain clients all the time. I mean, my dad loved food too, and loved restaurants, but would often do deals or end of deals or beginning of deals in restaurants. And I was always with him. So yeah, I got my education was in fine dining.
And what were some of the restaurants that you went to all the time?
Well, I mean, I was going to Le Cirque, Danielle, you know, in the early days, La Caravelle. I mean, it was back in the 80s and late 70s. And my dad traveled a lot. So I was off, you know, in Europe. And I don't mean to depict a rarefied existence. My dad actually grew up in the Depression and also was fired and started his own company when he had three kids and was really in very bad shape. But, you know, on the company expense, it was, you know, going out to these dinners. So, yeah, I mean, it was the best education possible. You know, it's like being a writer and reading a lot of books before you become a writer. You know, I got this education.
Which is unique to a New York upbringing in many ways.
For sure. And also to an upbringing where you're at business dinners when you're 9 years old. You
know? Yeah, on a corporate credit card. But
yeah.
Was there a cooking culture in the house?
No, my dad was a terrible cook, but he loved food. So is it not a cooking culture, but it's a food culture? He used to have someone come in once or twice a week and cook some meals for us and food, like ordering in, or that was the start of like Chinese food where you could order it in, right? I mean, so a love of food, but it was lowbrow and highbrow too, very lowbrow and highbrow. That was, everything was very democratic.
Right. Hi, everyone. Taking a quick break here to tell you a little bit about our season 5 sponsor, Le Cole School of Jewelry Arts, which is supported by the Maison Van Cleef & Arpels. In addition to exhibitions, publications, research projects, and public events, Le Cole offers a range of courses led by experts across jewelry, craft, history, and the arts. Celebrating its first decade this year, Le Cole, which has permanent campuses in both Paris and Hong Kong, is opening a third space in Shanghai and another in Paris, which will feature a public library of roughly 6,500 reference works on jewelry and gems. At its main Paris space, Le Cole is also opening a Gemotheque, or Gem Library, which contains some 1,200 stones for visitors to view and even handle. This year, they'll also be presenting 6 exhibitions in Hong Kong, Tokyo, and Paris, and publishing 8 books. You can learn more about L'Ecole and its current and upcoming offerings at www.lecolevancleefarpels.com. That's www.lecolevancleefarpels.com. And now back to the episode. Food and memory are so closely connected. Are there certain tastes that take you back to these early experiences with food?
Well, my dad, I mean, him being an awful cook, like he would try and cook like scrambled eggs for me in the mornings, you know. Man, his eggs were so bad. Oh my God. They were so overcooked and so dry. So that's a memory for me. But it's only a memory for me because my aunt, Toby, was an amazing cook. She went to the Cordon Bleu and she was very French influenced. And I remember being sick with strep throat when I was 12 and I couldn't eat anything. I couldn't swallow. But she made me scrambled eggs, whisking over a double boiler. You said, what food memories? I just remember the eggs sliding down my throat and the sort of transformational moment of seeing, feeling, understanding food is medicine, food is power, food is love. I can still taste the eggs going down my swollen throat. But in retrospect, I wouldn't have appreciated Toby's eggs if it hadn't been from my dad's. I really have my dad to thank for that. So it's the two things. It's your understanding, appreciation, and perception of things is so determined on what you're introduced to.
And the condition you come from.
The condition you
forces.
Come from. Yeah, sure.
I mean, the egg thing's funny because isn't that what chefs like, when you go to hire someone in your kitchen, isn't it like you have them make an egg?
You have them make an omelet.
An omelet.
So it's an egg, but it's a very particular skill to make a great omelet, but it's considered
baseline.
Necessary. And
right.
Yeah, and the sign of somebody who has a feeling for skill. And
you're so oriented to education and learning. This is kind of everything. Whether it was food, I feel like if you were doing anything, you would be really looking for where the upstream values were, where the education is. Were you a good student?
I was okay. I did actually work hard. I was surrounded by some friends who were super smart. And I always feel like I struggled to, they all went to very, very good colleges. And I went to Tufts. I was fine, but I had to work very hard. And that doesn't answer your question. Where does the curiosity come from? And maybe you're right. Maybe it would be that way for anything. But in food, it's endless. It's just endless. It's culturally, historically, scientifically, agriculturally, there's just everywhere you look, there's ways to think of and enrich yourself.
As a high school kid, though, were you like particularly interested in something? Because you hadn't really found food yet.
Well, I had to cook for myself. So a lot too, as I got into high school and my dad like stopped going out as much, I guess. And I don't know, I felt like I was actually always, during all those years, I was cooking a lot myself. So I had an interest in food, but I was sort of like, I don't know. In college, I cooked a little bit for some extra money. And yeah, I kind of dabbled in it from the beginning in actual cooking. But yeah, I didn't think I'd ever be a chef if that's what you're...
And you went to Tufts and you were studying literature.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, English major and political science. And there wasn't food.
And you thought you might be a novelist.
Right, yeah. Yeah, you've done your research. No, I sat down, I left college to write a novel and I was baking bread. You know, you say that and I just remembered, like my thought was, as I need to earn money. So I was like, okay, I'm going to bake bread at night and I'll write during the day. I literally never stopped to think, but when do you sleep? But that's what happens when you're in your early 20s. You're just filled with whatever. And you're like, okay, here's my plan. Bake at night, earn a paycheck, write during the day. I think I did that for one day and I was just like, oh my God.
But you worked at quite a famous place.
Yeah. Yeah. I worked at a great bakery. I just sort of walked in there and this woman, Nancy Silverton, let me come into her bakery for a year. It was great. It was, as I've always said, she fired me. So I was a terrible baker and I did not like working.
And you never got better at baking.
No, I've gotten better than that, but not much. I mean, it was a pretty low floor, I got to say. I was very confused. I don't love measuring out things. I really don't. I never have. The
right.
Preciseness of it. I don't love that.
Yeah, I mean, your cooking is about creating a space for this ingredient to come up.
Yeah, for all my cooks. So it's very intense, you know, it's just different kind of intensity than locking into a recipe. We don't really have recipes at Blue Hill. you know, people always say to me, like the other night I was in the kitchen and somebody who I haven't seen since like 2010 or so, you know, I walked to the kitchen and was like, the last time I saw you were standing right here, you know, at midnight, and here you are again. And it's, I was like, oh, you know, I don't know. That's, yeah, I'm in the kitchen all
the time. Your life. And there's sort of kitchen time that's different from garden time, that's different from fundraising time.
Yeah, I'm talking about service. I don't, you know, during the day, it's, I'm always checking in with things, but it's really when the first tickets come in that my day ends and my new day starts, I guess, is another way to say.
And does time shift for you? I mean, time in the kitchen and your perspective on time and perception of time.
Yeah, sometimes I wonder if like one of the things that draws cooks to immerse themselves in the evening hours in a way that is comprehensive. I mean, we can't duck out to check your cell phone. You can't duck out to take a phone call. You're in a zone for many hours and nothing enters that zone. I wonder if there's a kind of attraction to that, that is, you know, is addictive. And I wonder if it's some part of that isn't just very healthy too. You know, how often do we get to have in our day? I mean, people meditate, so there's that. I'm not suggesting that cooking is like meditating, because it's very stressful meditation, if that's what it is. But there is something to say for blocking everything out and being focused on the issue at hand. And so you don't get that opportunity in life these days that much.
Yeah.
So maybe there's something to it that really appeals to me.
But you didn't see that at La Brea Bakery. You got fired. You left that. And then you somehow got to the French Culinary Institute.
Well, I cooked in a bunch of restaurants and I got pretty good.
This was the thing. Left the bakery and then you were like, well,
yeah,
and restaurants.
Even during the bakery, I had started to cook a little bit before I went to the bakery because the writing wasn't working out. But then I was like, needed some more money. So I was doing some cooking and it like, you know, I could see that I was very athletic, and cooking, if you're an athlete, it's a big advantage, big, big one. So, you know, I was pretty good at that. And I was pretty mortified with being fired from the baking. And I told all my friends and everyone I was a baker, you know, and then the next day I wasn't a baker. And you're like, well, what the hell am I? And so now I'm a cook, I guess. I don't know, you know, and I could kind of do it and I could see myself getting better. And then I went to France and then it was all over because I was just that.
What brought you to France?
Well, I guess my wonderment of like, is this really something I want to do? Because if you go to France and you cook, you're serious, you know, very serious. Yeah, I think I was just like, I'm going to immerse myself in this for a couple of years. And once that happened, you know, there was no going back, I don't think.
So what was your first job where you had the actual position of chef?
Of chef, yeah, the restaurant that closed. That was my first.
Yeah, so what was that experience like?
It was a small bistro in the East Village in Nolita, actually, which now Lolita. Back then it was sort of Nolita. It was just beginning. I mean, these streets were just being taken over. It was Little Italy, which is what it was.
Yeah.
But then it was all of a sudden gentrified. And so it was this small place called La Cigale, and very informal but delicious food. And I mean, I thought it was delicious, but yeah, like I said, the ownership wasn't great and it went under. So I worked so hard, man. I mean, I was in there morning till night.
Cause it was your first, like it was yours.
Yeah. I had my name on it. And I just, I worked so hard, but it, you know, so when it closed, I was looking for a place. Actually, I had a catering business at the time. I was really looking for a place to just have a catering business. But then this, where Blue Hill is now, it's just opened up. It just, the owner was looking to get out. And so I swooped in and all, but before I know it, I had a restaurant. Yeah. It happened.
So that's
fast.
How Blue Hill happened.
Yeah. 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 It was not a big plan to have, a restaurant. It was a beautiful space. What I liked about it is that it was on a side street on Washington Place, which back then nobody could find. There was no Google.
You walk down steps.
You walk down
steps.
Exactly. You walk down steps, you bow your head, and the ceilings were really low. And that was at a moment when the 90s, this like the San Francisco architecture had hit New York for the first time, had gone that way, and big ceilings and
Balthazar.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was, you know, it was the age of like, it's sort of gilded, but it was restaurant as experience, restaurant as theater. And I just went in the opposite direction because, again, the space found me. I wasn't looking for that, but what I liked about it was low expectations. You walk in, you bow your head on this door, you walk down, it was an old speakeasy, right? So you walk in and the ceiling is not much higher than your head. And to me, it was like, okay. And I put paper on the tables and the silverware was purposely not very nice and the glassware was not very nice. And the idea was like, you're going to come in with an expectation and our food and our service is going to surpass the expectation. Maybe just a little bit, but that's okay. Because how often in life does your expectation and the value received, does it meet? And whenever we go to a movie, someone tells you a great movie, you go to the movie, like how many times does it surpass? I mean, never. So that was a nice little trick. And I think people were like, wow, this Blue Hills, like it, that was great. And that was,
it was
a
also
kind of
a
killing
way for you to kind of deal with this post-trauma of this.
Definitely.
Huge
low
failure.
Expectations,
yeah,
baby.
Like, don't the, watch me.
Exactly. Under promise, over deliver.
Totally.
Love it.
Totally. And that's how it happened. I mean, it became very quickly massive. And then all of a sudden, Stone Barns happens.
Yeah. Well, David Rockefeller walked in to the restaurant.
Yeah, so tell us the story.
He walked into the restaurant to have a meal. Tim Zagat was a real fan of Blue Hill and loved the low expectations, loved that it was jiu-jitsuing the direction the restaurants were going. And he was very savvy. He got a feel for a place and saw that it was filled with energy. And I was lucky enough to be surrounded by some good people. And he could feel that. And then when David Rockefeller said, you know, I'm thinking of my old family farm to have a place for me to eat because my home is next door and there's no place to eat in Westchester. And so he said, you should really meet this young chef and his brother, David, who's my business partner. And Mr. Rockefeller walks in and I think he was taken by the food and the experience, but I think he was taken by the family. My brother, my sister-in-law is the designer. And I think he loved that ethos and felt very comfortable and then wanted to convert the farm into something that, and I didn't want a restaurant. I didn't want another restaurant, but what I wanted was a farm. So he was open to the idea of expanding the farm from the initial idea of what Stone Barns could be, because he was interested in having us as a partner and we were interested in the farming part and the restaurant came with it. And then, you know, there it is.
And how long after this did the new restaurant open? Like you had opened
Blue
Hill.
We opened Blue Hill in 1999. And we opened Stone Barns in 2004. So it was pretty quick, actually, to be honest with you.
I'm sure it didn't feel that way in the moment.
It felt like all consuming. It was all consuming to open my little restaurant in West Village. It was like, I just went and did it again. I could never do that kind of thing now. I mean, I have a family now, but that was hard. And also driving back and forth. You know, I drive an hour there and drive an hour back. And to this day, 20 years later, I'm still doing it.
You've spoken in the past about how influential Elliot Coleman was and has been on your life and work. And I was just curious about that. Who is he? Why have you mentioned him?
I read Elliot Coleman in the library in college. Yeah, I used to go to the library because I thought I couldn't get anything done in my dorm room. But I go to the library and just pick books off the shelf and just lie on the floor and read books and not do my work. And I happened to be in the environmental section, nature section, and there was Elliot Coleman's book about four-season farming. But I had a little bit of that experience from Blue Hill Farm. So the farm shut down from partly because I was in school from October to May, but also partly it shut down. It was winter and literally. But then here he was saying, well, that doesn't need to happen. And that there's a way to farm actively, passionately, beautifully in the dead of winter. And there he was on the cover in the dead of winter farming spinach and root vegetables. And I was just like, God, this is so kooky. And then reading, I started to see like, well, here's a guy who moved from California to Maine to follow his dream of getting off the grid, but he was frustrated by the growing season. And in his frustration, he looked at a map and had like a Isaac Newton moment. He like hit him on his head. He was like, wait a minute, I'm on the same latitude as Southern France. That means I have the same amount of sunlight. I may have very differing temperatures because of the jet stream and whatever, but I have the same number of hours of sunlight. If you can grow stuff in South France, grow stuff here. That was the beginning of recognizing that daylight vegetables that were daylight determined, light determinant, not temperature determinant, could grow and grow well. I just thought it was fascinating. I was like, Jesus, man, why the hell isn't anyone else talking about this?
So the offer of having a farm and this moment of having a restaurant and a farm.
Well, it was an excuse to call Elliot. Here was my guru. I'd never met him. I'd read everything he'd ever written. I'd listened to every back then it was cassette tape talk that he'd ever had. I thought the guy was a genius. He was a real foodie too. So it's really spoke to me. He loves food. Elliot, he's just a gourmet and a gourmand. The guy's amazing, amazing taste now that I know him well. But that was my excuse to reach out to him. So I wrote him this note. I was like, dear Mr. Coleman, I've been approached by David Rockefeller. Like, I don't know what to do. And who else would I turn to but you? Because you're the reason that I'm thinking about this. I thought, okay, he's never going to write me back. And he wrote me right back. I was like, gee, I couldn't believe it. Because to me, he was the demigod. And luckily for me, he said, yes, of course, I will take this project on. And he really helped us build the four-season philosophy of this farm that became the Stone Barn Center.
Wow. you were one of the first in this farm to table conversation. So ahead of all of this, I just want to reel back a little bit. What introduced you to the farm to table? I mean, you were at Chez Panisse, you had experiences in this, correct?
I wasn't one of the first. I should be careful of that one. I maybe articulated it in a deeper way.
You're one of the first noticed, I think, in a way, as a storyteller.
I think the answer to that just goes back to like my simplicity, because it started with like, things better be fresh, because if they're not, I'm naked on the plate and it's not hard to tell. So it kind of started with that.
And how much does that connect to your original desire to become a novelist? These two things to me seem very clear. You know, you
tell me. I can figure this out now.
You wanted fiction. You wanted to tell a story. And how do we set up novels? How do writers design stories? This is similarly to how you design your meals. You know, there's storytelling imbued.
You know, I've
in all
never
of
thought
it.
Of it that way. That's very interesting.
You never thought of the fact that your meals unravel in the way that...
Yes, I've thought of it that way, but I never thought of the connection to storytelling as a novelist and my original desire. That's very interesting.
I thought that would be very clear to you. That's funny. I mean, the service, the experience, the way you hold the space for the reader or the eater seems like it came from the space of a novelist. Mm. So do you think in
never
essence...
Never been told that. You, have you eaten? I never even asked you. When was the last time you ate?
Of course. I haven't been to Stone Barns.
Oh, you haven't been to Stone Barns. Oh,
but I've been to Blue Hill in the West Village several times.
All right, we got to
get
to Stone
Barns. In fact, we met many years ago. I had dinner there when it was a tough table to get with a band that was hot at the time that I came in with friends of mine.
Okay.
You came out and you knew one of the guys. You stopped to talk to one of us.
Okay.
And you kind of explained what we were eating.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
But anyhow... In the way that you lose yourself in fiction, I mean, you talk about sitting on the library floor, you talk about losing yourself in this idea. Is that what you hope happens when people eat at your restaurants?
Well, the story stuff is the end to a larger, where the vectors don't point at me, but they point out. And that gives meaning to the experience of what's going on there. That's very powerful, you know, and transformative, actually. And like, it goes back to what I was saying before, which I didn't recognize when I started all this. I don't want to sound like I had all the pieces put together in my mind. And
No one does.
Yeah. It's all, what did Steve Jobs say? You do the stuff backwards, you know? But if I do it backwards, you start to realize that what an opportunity to tell a story. I mean, what an opportunity. Because when do you get people's attention for 3 hours? I mean, that's what I have at Stone Barns, is a three-hour meal. When do you get people's attentions for 3 hours around a table in a context of delight and, you know, hedonism, pleasure, with generally with people who love each other, not always the case, but mostly in a beautiful surrounding without cell phone, email, text interruption, cable TV interruption. Where? When does that happen? Never. I mean, never. And that opportunity, it increasingly is so precious and so powerful. And I'm taking advantage of it. That's what I'm doing. I'm taking advantage. I'm digging into that. And I think that's why restaurants could play a role in being broadcasters for a larger message. It doesn't have to be about agriculture and farming and health. It doesn't have to be about that. It'd be about any kind of social movement that's happening. Look, it could be a restaurant connected to a nonprofit, to a museum that's having an exhibit on something. And it, food, community, around the table, the storytelling of a meal could be part of that experience. And I think that's a viable future for restaurants.
And there are so many people thinking that way now. And I wonder, maybe I'm like projecting this out onto you, but this idea of when you set up the scenes of a meal, I kind of imagine as someone who wanted to be a novelist, that you think about how this experience through time, how time is this factor of these scenes unraveling because of how you've approached these massive multi-course meals. You know, it's like many, many scenes. Do you think about it that way?
We do actually set up the menu with mini stories we want to tell, but I'm always thinking, like, well, what's the arc? You know, what do you come in with and what do you leave with where there's a tying it together? Because, you know, if there's not, you're left with a bunch of like nice memories, but not a cohesiveness. And isn't that what a good novelist does? There's this famous story of Chekhov and the Three Sisters. You ever hear this? Where he's did the last rehearsal for Three Sisters and the reviewer wrote him a telegram in the hotel room and said, this is the greatest play ever. And the scene when the husband said, was asked, tell me about your wife. He said, my wife is the moon and the stars. My wife is she's my everything to me, from soil to heaven. It is the most brilliant moment in the history of playwright. And Chekhov puts down telegram and goes to the script and puts an X through the whole scene. And then he tells the director, tomorrow when he asks, tell me about your wife, I want him to say, a wife is a wife. It was so memorable and so well written, and he poured his heart into it, but he recognized that that would be the takeaway from the play. And if that was the takeaway from the play, you don't get to the higher sense of it. And that's why I feel like when we do sort of bells and whistles with dishes and courses, like, careful, guys, we're not trying to make the mark here. Either it's too early or it's too distracted from an overall whatever we're doing, and it's gimmicky. And those gimmicks are powerful because people love them.
Yeah.
But they don't last. If you want something to last, there cannot be one dish and there cannot be one scene that steals the show. Otherwise, it's not real art. You know, it rises to another level.
Totally. The best meals I've ever had, when someone says, what'd you eat? I don't know.
Exactly. I was just about to say that.
No idea.
Just about to say that. My biggest compliment is, well, what'd you eat? I don't know. But man, that was a great meal. Good. Yeah. Good. You did it.
I want to get into one of these programs that you did, the Wasted program, which I think is fascinating. And there's a lot about story there. I mean, you used skate wing cartilage, eggs without fully formed shells, bok choy that's been attacked by flea beetles, cucumber butts, leftover vegetable pulp from juicers. Was this about finding the unexpected, discovering use in the discarded? What was this initiative about?
The initiative was about people beginning to talk about food waste and my frustration that restaurants were being taken to task as places of great waste. I just thought that was ridiculous. Chefs, any chef, not just me, any chef, we do more for food waste than, I mean, our DNA is about utilizing the scraps and making them into, that's the history of food, for God's sakes. I mean, that's all cuisines. What's a coq au vin? Coq au vin is a rooster that tastes like this chair that I'm sitting on, unless you braise it in white wine and vegetables, and it becomes the most, like, you know, what's bouillabaisse? Bouillabaisse is the discarded and ugly fish that no one would buy at the market, simmered together into a beautiful broth. Now, they don't call those things food waste soup, you know?
Yeah.
You call it bouillabaisse and it's iconic, but that's every day. So I just felt like we should wear this stuff on our sleeve because every chef is making, I mean, last night I did a ravioli of scraps of lamb. I didn't call it scraps of lamb ravioli. You know, I called it braised lamb ravioli winter vegetables, you know, but that's food waste. So I just wanted to call it, wear it on our sleeve, take it a step further and then celebrate it, which, you know, turned into, I think we hit the zeitgeist at that moment because it was a crazy response.
Well, you also served, like, you know, a group of world leaders.
Yeah, the UN. We could serve like the 12 presidents, leaders. Except for Obama, but everybody was there. It was amazing. That was the sort of apotheosis of this whole thing. It's funny. It's like, I look back on that time. We've had so many offers to do more around food waste and I have said no to everything because I feel like the message that I wanted to get across was that if you do your jobs right as chefs, you end up not creating pop-ups and restaurants devoted to food waste because food waste is a part of everything you do and it should be a part of our food system. It should be soaking up all the food waste and be part of our food culture. When you advertise it as these gimmicky, well, exciting skate wing thing and eggs that don't have shells and pulp burgers from juice pulp. You know, it's a good, great stories. It's 1,000 stories. But the end of the day, they add up to, like, if they aren't inculcated the every day, then they just stay as like ingenious ideas for the moment. And I just didn't want to do that.
Seems like you say what you have to say. If you said it well, you move on.
Yeah. Well, the moving on is incorporate these into the everyday menus, which I had always done. And maybe we double down a little bit harder now because I expanded my mind. But I think every chef does. That's why the Wasted, it's Waste, E-D, capital E-D, is Waste Education. We invited a chef every night to come in and do dishes with us and show what they do in their own restaurant. So
did you ever encounter a food item you couldn't do anything with?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we were pushing the envelope on stuff that was not dumpster dive stuff, but stuff that, you know, it was tough to, I'm just trying to think of examples without the yuck factor. But, you know, people's minds were open to things that they otherwise would not have been open to. So, you know, offal is wasted in the United States. Offal is the best part of the animal. You know, chefs go through hula hoops to hide offal into these dishes. And so we wore it on our sleeve. But really the best dish for me of all the, we did 100 dishes, and the best thing we served was cow corn. Corn that's fed to cows. We got some of that and we actually made it into a cracker that was halfway edible and add a lot of other stuff to make it delicious. It didn't get enough play. To me, it was the most exciting story. It was like, there's 90 million acres of this stuff. We don't eat 1 ounce of it. It all gets fed to a cow or it gets fed to our gas tanks. It is the single greatest waste of natural resources in the history of the world, 90 million acres. It's the most elitist, most undemocratic, most unhealthy, most environmentally degradation food in the history of the world. And here it is for you to eat and think about the 90 million acres. And what if we took this mediocre cracker and made it into something like a grain like buckwheat or barley or rye or wheat or anything that we could eat directly instead of feeding through a cow? That is cutting down on food waste. And that was the point of that. In the end, that's what I wanted to get across. If you think that the dumpster dive, the ugly fruits and vegetables is the thing that we should be cutting down on, you're on the wrong thing. That's nothing. That's the red herring. That's the thing that gets you down the wrong road. It's minuscule. The food waste in this country is about how we feed animals. And if you have a protein-centric diet, which is what our diet is, and we're exporting, unfortunately, to the rest of the world, it is the single most wasteful diet in the history of the world. And that's what we need to fix. Protein, by the way, fish too. And that's why my menu was filled with an alternate way to look at a plate of food, which is what all great restaurants do. You know, you don't go to a great restaurant today and find a 6 ounce piece of protein on your plate or multiple courses of that. That just doesn't happen anymore. And that is the future, I think, of really sustainable eating. Anyway, wasted was another way to get into that subject, but I don't think that really caught on. I think the dumpster dive dishes and the ones that were shock and awe were the ones that really got the play in the media, unfortunately.
Well, I mean, you've been telling a story about sustainability-driven, ecologically-based, hyper-local. These are things that you've been talking about for quite a while. In 2014, you did a very famous TED Talk that traveled far and wide. People still watch it, right? Yeah. And you talk about how you hate getting this question, well, how are you going to feed the world? And I just wanted to take a second while I had you here to ask about that, why you dislike the question so much and why you think it's probably just a totally misguided, wrong question.
Well, it's a question coming from interests that want you to think that way. So it gets very confusing when you ask that question because you're forced into answering, how are you going to do that? Instead of looking at the hard question, why are we taking 190 million acres of some of the most blessed farm soil resources in the world and feeding it through a cow? That is the most wasteful use of resources we could ever imagine. It's also unhealthy. It's also not that delicious. So I don't like the question because it traps you.
Right.
And the immediate answer to the question is we already produce enough calories on Earth to feed two Earths. Now, and we're in a degraded moment. We already feed that. What we have is a very undemocratic distribution system. That's the problem. It isn't the tonnage, and it hasn't been a tonnage problem for 30 years, but the industry will keep coming back to that always. So that's why I bristle at the question. If we just produce more food, 1/3 of Americans that are food insecure today would be food secure. Bullshit.
It doesn't happen.
Never. No. I think what you just said is a good point. You know, you let go of your responsibility to really advocate for a kind of democratic system and a political system, an educational system, a distribution system that is more equitable. And we do not do that. And it starts with seed. We're four companies that are chemical companies control what you eat. That's right. The problem. That's why I went to seeds.
Yeah.
So if you want to answer how are we going to feed the world, you start with seeds. Because if we don't get seeds out of corporate control and back into the hands of communities, indigenous communities, disenfranchised communities, every kind of farming community there is, regional and otherwise, we are going to lose the fight.
So I have a ridiculous question. If we were to follow this, the table should service the farm idea,
yeah.
A quote from you.
Yeah, good one. Did I say that? That's
you did nice. Say that. Yeah. If we modeled big ag on this bottom-up approach, which I know is absurd, what might the planet look like?
Much more regional. Big ag just takes advantage of an enormous distribution system. That's Big Ag. That's all it is. If we could invest our tax dollars into a regional infrastructure system, it's we could grow plenty of food in this region to feed this region. Plenty. As a farmer said to me in upstate New York, we could grow more grains just in this region that would bury New York City, bury it. But we have very few mills. We have very few processors. We have very few distributors. We have no elevators to store grain. And so all that has been dismantled and moved to the Midwest and the West. And that's where the food costs, that's where more expensive food comes from. It's not from farming. Everyone says, well, farming, you know, diversity is expensive. No, it's not. No, it's not. If you eat the diversity, it's not more expensive and it's not more inefficient. But the reason it's inefficient now is because we're taking that diversity, getting it from the farm to your plate, you don't stand a chance in individual regional economies. You only can make it in the world of big ag distribution. And that is something that's, I said the seed world is 100 years old. It always strikes us crazy.
It's shocking.
It's crazy. But our food system is only 50 years old. Before 1965, 1970, we were in a regional food economy. Like the Rockefeller scientist said, COVID hits in 1975. You don't have COVID, you have a flu season. That's what you have. And a lot of that has to do with how our food was grown. The cost of this big ag distribution system is very, very expensive. And I keep coming back to seed because seed is the enabler. You cannot have a big food distribution without seed. And seed is what controls it. So unfortunately, they control the game right now. We got to stop that.
So before we wrap up, and I let you go, and I let the listeners return to their lives. They're probably cooking right now, actually.
I hope so. That's one thing you can do, by the way. I said that, you know, vote with your fork, but it's so hard to do. But one thing to do for your own personal health, and I do think this is a democratic idea, is cook. So I know you're joking, but also it's a very powerful move. It's like you cook for yourself and your family. You are, by definition, cooking better food, healthier food, less wasteful food, food that's less degrading on the environment.
I think a lot of people listen to our podcasts when they're cooking.
I bet.
This like connection between the two things. But what I wanted to ask is, there's a food critic I wrote that said, your goal as a chef is ultimately to change the world.
Did I say that?
You didn't say that.
Oh.
A food critic, Ruth Reichel, said
yeah.
that. She said, your goal as a chef is ultimately to change the world.
Me. She was talking about me.
But I'm wondering if you believe that the goal of a chef today should be to take part in this conversation and ultimately shift how these
things
work.
Yeah, I think we have a responsibility. I think that was very important what you said today. So I don't know that that was true 30 years ago. We're on some kind of pedestal. I don't get it. Do you? I think it's weird. But
that chefs are stars.
Yeah.
I mean, it happened in architecture. It's happening in a lot of different industries.
It happened in architecture. It's interesting.
The Starchitect.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I mean, the Frank Gehry of it all. Like this has happened in ultimate industries, the chef as, you know, cultural figure, whether it's good or bad or worthy or not, I don't know if an actor should have more than a chef should.
Right. That's what I'm saying. And yet, here we are. So I'd like to do something with it. That's what I'm saying.
You know, exactly.
Totally. I just read a survey that said the top professions ranked in terms of public trust, politicians, I don't think politicians were in the 20, but it was like doctors were like 12. I was like, oh my God, lawyers were like, you know, 19, whatever. Chefs, number one, most trusted industry. when chefs speak, it's the number one most trusted thing. It's like, well, that's interesting.
You know,
it's
like, so what are you going to do with it?
But what are you going to do with it? What can you do with it? That should drive every chef, not out of being an army of virtue, but merchants of happiness, because that's where joy, I mean, that's a very powerful way to shift opinion and shift consciousness, happiness, pleasure. That's one thing Americans cleave to, you know, and chefs are in the cockpit of driving that. Let's do something with it. And I think there's a real role for restaurants to play. And that's what dials back to the beginning of our conversation, the loss of restaurants and their potential to influence these conversations, I think, is profound and hopefully won't be as bad as I'm predicting.
Well, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks so much, man. Appreciate it.
Extra thanks to our season 5 sponsor, Le Cole School of Jewelry Arts, which is supported by the Maison, Van Cleef & Arpels. a unique place for learning. L'École welcomes the general public to the world of jewelry through courses, conferences, exhibitions, videos, and book publications. You can find out more about L'École at www.lecolevancleefarpels.com. That's www.lecolevancleefarpels.com. And thank you for listening. You can find more episodes of Time Sensitive on our website, timesensitive.fm, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can listen to our other podcast, At a Distance, by heading to atadistancepodcast.com. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. And if you like our program, please be sure to subscribe and leave comments. Our theme music was composed by Billy Martin. This episode was produced by Emily Jang, Tiffany Zhao, Mike Lala, and Johnny Simon.